This is Christine King in conversation with Dr. Gerhard Hertzberg at the National Research Council of Canada in Ottawa, 5th of May 1986. Dr. Hertzberg first came to Canada from Germany in 1935. In 1945, he went to the University of Chicago, but returned to Canada in 1948, and has been here at the National Research Council since. Dr. Hertzberg is one of those rare physicists who has won a Nobel Prize in chemistry. Dr. Hertzberg, you were born on Christmas Day 1904 in Hamburg. Your father died when you were only 10. Did your mother have any special interest? Sorry.
I would say 11. I was... I was 11.
Did your mother have any special interest or early ambitions for you or your brother in the scientific domain?
No.
Not at all?
Not at all. My mother was not interested in science, put it that way. She didn't have the education to be interested in science.
So your interest arose entirely from your own endeavors?
And from my teachers.
Yes. That was my next question. You spent your entire school years in Hamburg, apart from a short stay in Frankfurt.
Yes.
At school, you first became interested in atomic and molecular physics. Can you recall how this came about?
Yes. We had a teacher at the school in which I was, which was a branch of one of the oldest Hamburg schools, the so-called Johanneum, and this was the natural sciences part of the Johanneum, if you want to put it that way. It wasn't called that way. It was called Realgymnasium, this Johanneum. And one of the teachers in physics and mathematics was a man by the name of Hillers, H-I-L-L-E-R-S. And he was a very competent physicist. He edited, together with another person, a textbook in physics, which is still used after, I don't know, 50 or more years. In universities in Germany, it is called Grimmsels. I have it right here. It's a little dilapidated by now. This is that book. It's in two volumes. This is one of the two volumes. It was in two volumes. I think it's more volumes now. But you can find here the name. You see, Grimmsel was a teacher at another school in Hamburg, but he was killed during the First War. And so he only looked after the first edition of this. Hillers and this man Starke looked after a number of further editions, I don't know how many. But this particular one, you can see his name here, edited by this man. Now, this man gave a series of lectures at the school ahead of the regular school time. We started at 8 o'clock and this was at 7 o'clock or something like that in the morning. And he was not only a good lecturer, but he also knew modern physics as of that time. And I certainly owe him a great deal for stimulating me to be interested in atomic and molecular physics.
Do you remember any other courses that you took during these years which influenced you into science, mathematics, chemistry?
Well, my interest in science actually arose more from the side of astronomy, I would say. That was before I got to listen to Hillers. I had a friend in school with whom we built a small, very primitive telescope, And so we read up about astronomy, and that seemed to excite me. And of course, even at that time, it was fairly clear that if you wanted to make any headway in astronomy, you had to know some physics and mathematics. And since I was doing well in those subjects, it was natural, although astronomy as such was not taught at school, it was natural that I emphasized that. Of course, I did chemistry as well, and we had a fairly good teacher in chemistry. We didn't have this man, Hillers, as our classroom teacher. He taught other classes. I don't even know whether he only taught physics or what. I don't remember. But we had some very poor teachers also. We had a very good teacher in mathematics most of the time, who wrote several textbooks in mathematics. But we had one person in physics who didn't really know very much in physics. He came from meteorology. But even so, there was some degree of inspiration from him, because he told us sometimes how some of his friends did in research, and that somehow seemed to appeal to me. I remember one particular occurrence. He told us about a friend who was working at the analog of the, in Germany, of the National Bureau of Standards. And he asked him at one time, "What are you working on?" And he said, "I'm calibrating a thermometer." And after a year or so, he met this man again, and what are you doing? He said, and he said, "I'm calibrating a thermometer." "Not the same one." "Yes, the same one." And that impressed me.
So you went to the same school during all these things, there's a sense of continuity.
After leaving Frankfurt, yes, that is right, until I got the equivalent of grade 12 or 13 or whatever. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So by the time you finished school, you had decided to become an astronomer, but you were dissuaded from this ambition by financial factors. You then decided to study engineering physics at the Technical University in Darmstadt. First, what attracted you to astronomy? You said that you built a little telescope. Was this...
Well, I mean, anyone who looks... At that time, you could still see the stars when you walked through the streets of Hamburg. You know, nowadays, because you can't see the stars anymore. And anyone who is awake must be wondering what does it all mean, so that I didn't escape that question. But I would like to tell you the little story about, you said, I was discouraged from going into astronomy. The question was more specific in that I went to a vocational guidance bureau, which existed even at that time in Hamburg, and they took my question, "How do I go about becoming an astronomer," very seriously, and they wrote to the then director of the Hamburg Observatory, who was a well-established scientist and whose name was, as I later on found, very well known in astronomy, and a man by the name of Shaw, if I remember correctly. But he wrote back to the Vocational Guidance Bureau to transmit to me the message that if this young man has financial backing, then of course, by all means encourage him to go into astronomy, but if he doesn't, there's no way of making a living, so do something else. That came directly from the director of the Hamburg Observatory.
Have you ever regretted that you didn't somehow try to obtain funds and push on with your ambition?
Not really, no. I throughout my career, I felt really quite happy with what I was doing. But it became pretty soon clear to me when I started as an engineering physics student that basic physics was more to my liking. But I did actually take some engineering subjects like what is it called in English? Descriptive geometry, for example, about which I learned a lot more than normally a physicist would learn. And I did, in that connection, I did even do some drafting and things of that sort that the engineers had to do. Because it was quite, it was an engineering school, and my degree, my final degree, or both degrees that I have from that university are engineering degrees. It's only more recently that they also give a degree that isn't called engineering, that is a degree in natural sciences. But at the time I took my work, it was only a doctor of engineering degree that I was able to get at that university.
But do you think that this practical application has helped you later when you need to design apparatus? And
I think so, yes. Yes, I think so. Not on all that many occasions, but there were certainly occasions where my training in descriptive geometry and in the art of technical drawing were of considerable help.
Mm-hmm. The other question I wanted to ask in connection with what we've been saying was it then a relatively easy matter for you to be funded to study physics in Germany at that time, as opposed to astronomy?
No, that was the next question. I had, of course, no... at that time, it was really quite difficult, and another school pal of mine, to whom I was fairly close, his father, when we were sitting around the supper table once in his place, when we discussed the question of what to do when I was finished with school, he said, "Why don't you write to Stinnis?" I don't know whether this was going to mean anything to you, but Stinnis at that time was the biggest industrial firm in Germany after the First War. It was mainly shipbuilding and this sort of thing. And I thought that was, knowing that Stinnis was a big industrialist, multimillionaire and whatnot, I didn't really all that much appreciate this suggestion, but in desperation I did write a letter to Stinnis, and lo and behold, an answer came back, not from Stinnis himself, but from some assistant of his. And eventually I got a private private support from Mr. Stinnis. And that went on, and on the strength of that, I was able to go to this place in Darmstadt to start my studies. But the trouble was that after 2 years, the big firm, Stinnis, went broke. And that was the end of my private fellowship. But fortunately, by that time, I had learned to know, first of all, the professor of physics in Darmstadt and other people. And just at that time, the German government had established a sort of fellowship scheme for the best students in the country, which was called Studienstiftung des Deutschen Volkes, and was a countrywide thing. I mean, I don't know how many fellowships they had at the beginning, but I was able, on the strength of the recommendation of my professor, I was able to get one of the first fellowships, or bursaries, if you will, might be a better expression, of this organization, and could therefore complete my studies. At the same time, of course, I was also employed as assistant in the lab, and so I earned some extra money that way.
So by a combination of financial means, you completed your university training, which began in 1924, and subsequently received your doctorate degree in engineering physics in 1928. You worked for Hans Rau, mm-hmm. who had been a student of Wien.
Yes.
And he gave you great freedom in choosing your
yes.
line of research.
That's right.
And it seems that after reading Sommerfeld's Atomic Structure and Spectral Lines, you had some very good ideas. And you said that this was it was an obvious idea to you to try and produce the spectrum of the lithium 2+. And could you tell me if this idea seemed obvious to you at the time, or just obvious in retrospect?
Yes, it was. It was very obvious. Because it was at the time when Niels Bohr had pronounced his theory of atomic structure, and it was formulated on the basis of the hydrogen atom, and very soon after, I don't know whether it was Sommerfeld himself or somebody else, had applied this theory to a similar system, except that the charge, the central charge, was one unit higher. That is the helium plus, which is the next element in the periodic system. And helium plus is therefore entirely similar to hydrogen, except for a factor of 4 in the energy levels and in the, if you like, in the spectral lines. And not exactly 4, but very close to 4. And if you extrapolate that, it's obvious that you go to the next element and take one more charge, add one charge, leave only one electron around a nucleus with charge 3, then you get again a spectrum very similar to hydrogen, and except that the factor is now, instead of 4, it is 9, the square of the atomic charge. So that can't be considered as a very deep thought, and I, in a retrospect, I found that many people tried it, but for one thing, I wasn't successful. I didn't really try very hard because I was sidetracked on something else, in fact, on something molecular. I never got far enough, but in the meantime, the spectrum of lithium plus is known fairly well.
You said that you were, this was the time Bohr's theory was being aired. Do you remember whether there was much excitement? Were people very excited by the new developments?
I think it's fair to say. Of course, you have to remember that Bohr's theory at the time that I started to study in 1924 was still 12 years old, and people were trying to find ways and means to understand the results of Bohr's theory and under with more background than he had, and there were certain unresolved riddles in the Bohr theory, which then in 1925, only 1 year later, or 25 and 26, were solved by Heisenberg and Schrödinger. And so during the real excitement, if I put it that way, came years later when Schrödinger published his paper, or a series of papers, and Heisenberg. I was more impressed by Schrödinger because it was easier to understand. Heisenberg's theory is somewhat more abstract, but they actually amount to the same thing, as has been shown later by Schrödinger, both Schrödinger and Heisenberg. So that time, 25, 26, was really a very exciting time in physics.
Yes. This anticipates my next question. After you finished your doctoral work, you went to Göttingen for a year in 1928. That was a glorious time to be there.
Yes.
If it's not too difficult a question, can you recall some of the people that you worked with and the general atmosphere of the day?
Well, almost the first person that I met in Göttingen was a man who was only a few years older than I was, by the name of Heitler, H-E-I-T-L-E-R, and he was already at that time the initiator, together with Fritz London, of the valence theory of molecular bonds. You have to.
No, I just thought I might turn it around so I can see when this thing actually starts. This is fine. Please carry on.
It's all right?
Yes, it's fine.
I had found some experimental results while still in Darmstadt about certain molecules like CN and N2+. And I discussed them with Heitler on the basis of his theory. And we thought we had an interesting development in that theory, but it turned out to be wrong, or not very significant, if you like. So that was not in any way a significant piece of work, but it gave me a start to talk to people. And of course the people I was really wanting to work with were James Franck, who was an experimentalist, and Max Born, who was a theoretician. I don't know whether I ever thought of becoming a theoretician. I don't think I did, but I spent officially, at any rate, the first 6 months in Göttingen in Max Born's institute, and the second 6 months in James Franck's institute. And there, of course, were a number of rather outstanding people in both institutes. And of course, they had a stream of visitors from this continent and from elsewhere. That came in, and so one learned really to meet a lot of people. One person with whom I worked while he was a guest worker in James Franck's laboratory was a man by the name of Scheibe. At that time he was in Erlangen in Germany, in Bavaria. Later he was at the Technical University in Munich. And we did one piece of work together that was the first extension to the ultraviolet, vacuum ultraviolet, of the spectra of the methyl halides. And people are still working on it off and on. But I think it was a fairly significant piece of research, nothing very record-breaking or fundamental, if you like, but after all, science doesn't proceed in big steps, it proceeds in very small steps, and this is one small step ahead. Then during my time there, a paper was published by Wigner and Widmer, which was very fundamental for molecular spectroscopy. And I studied this paper very carefully, and it stimulated me to develop a paper on the dissociation energy of the oxygen molecule, which is a very important molecule. And I feel that was a fairly important step in the development of molecular spectroscopy.
Had you met Wigner personally, Father?
And Wigner also was a visitor there. He's still alive and still active, but he must be about, I would say he must be 85 or something like that, I know.
But he travels a great deal, just like you.
Yes, he traveled a great deal. He came, of course, from Hungary, from Budapest, and was a very extraordinary theoretician.
Mm-hmm.
He was one person. I don't know all the others. And another person I met was a man by the name of Winans. He's also still around. He's retired from the University of Buffalo. He was, during most of his life, at the University of Wisconsin. He was not, well, this is now something that I wouldn't like to be published, but he was not a very strong physicist or chemist. But he did one important step right at that time when I was there. He published, together with a Swiss theoretician by the name of Stückelberg, who died recently and who was very well thought of as a theoretical physicist. The two together, they were both young men at the time, published a paper on the continuous spectrum of the hydrogen molecule. Now, I had been thinking when I was in Darmstadt still of the interpretation of this spectrum, and I had an idea which turned out to be quite childish in retrospect, but I was aware of the facts, and when I saw this manuscript, it was first circulated as a manuscript in Göttingen, I was immediately clear that was the explanation of this spectrum, and it has stood up in the course of time. And that was done by this man Winans and Stückelberg. Stückelberg became one of the very prominent physicists, although not all that many people know of his name, but he was doing really extraordinary good work, but he had trouble with illness all his life. Winans, one can't really say that for him. He didn't live up to the promise, but he did this one important piece of work together with Stückelberg. Now, I don't know who was the originator, but I think that I would guess that Winans brought the problem to Stückelberg, and Stückelberg solve the problem, if you like. Anyway, it's a very fine piece of wood, and I became aware of it as soon as I got to Göttingen, because this manuscript was floating around by various people.
Mm-hmm.
So those are two instances that I can remember. I don't know. I don't always remember everything right away. There's one a strange, if you like, coincidence. Among the visitors, I met a person whose name, a Dutch chemist or physicist. The name of this Dutch physicist whom I met during my stay in Göttingen was Droevestein. And he talked about his work he was doing, not about anything that was of particular interest to me, but some 45 or 50 years later, I became aware of something that he had done just about that time. He had found a spectrum which, however, he couldn't explain and analyze. I became interested in this spectrum here in Ottawa a few years ago. It was earlier than that. 15 years ago, shall I say. And we solved the riddle of that spectrum, and it was an interesting experience. And again, nothing world-shaking, but a contribution that I think will remain, maybe expanded in other spectrum or something.
Whilst you were at Göttingen, you decided that you would like to try and publish some of the lectures you've given in the form of a book. Mm-hmm. This was the beginning of something very great, of course. Can we skip chronology and could you talk a little bit then about your...
This matter arose in connection with a series of informal lectures, perhaps half a dozen or so, which I was presenting in one of the... There were at the time three physics institutes in Göttingen. I was attached to the second physics institute, that was the Institute of James Franck. But the first institute of physics was the Institute of Professor Pohl, and it was not Pohl but some of his younger colleagues who asked me whether I couldn't explain to them some of the elements of molecular theory, which I did. And at the time, one of the people who came to listen was this same Professor Scheiber I mentioned earlier, with whom I did some work in the lab on actual spectra, like the methyl halides. And he was actually the one who suggested that I should write up these lectures in the form of a book. And he had a connection with a publisher by the name of Steinkopf, located in Dresden at the time in Germany. There was no East and West at that time. And he made this connection, and so I got a request from this publisher, would I be prepared to write a book on atomic and molecular spectra? And that was to be a book of some 160 pages. Well, gradually I got busy trying to write this book, and when I had written the atomic part of the book on atomic and molecular spectra, it turned out that it was already more than 160 pages. So I split off the atomic part, and it was published actually... I handed in the manuscript before I left Germany, and it was published during my first year in Saskatchewan.
So 1936,
yes. Mm-hmm. And strangely, it is still being sold. On my way over from Germany to Saskatchewan, I visited in Princeton, and I met Professor E.U. Condon, C-O-N-D-O-N, who had just started as editor of a series of physics texts for the Prentice Hall Company, and he said, couldn't you translate this book and we publish it in this series? And of course, I jumped on this opportunity. But I was a little leery about doing the translation myself because my English wasn't quite as firm as it might be, and also there was a lot of work. So Dr. Spinks in Saskatchewan volunteered to do the translation. We then went over the manuscript together to iron out some points or other, and it was published by the Prentice Hall Company, I think in 1937, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the point is that they, when the war started and the book began to be sold out, they wrote to me, we cannot reprint it because we need our paper for more profitable books. And so they handed back the copyright to me, and I then of course looked for some other publisher to reprint the book, and I got to Dover Publications, and they took it on. It's a reprint company anyway, and they have kept it in print ever since, and by now they have sold more than 100,000 copies. So that's Prentice Hall lost.
Would you like to say a little bit more about your other volumes now, or shall we talk about it later?
Well, this might be a suitable occasion because it fits mm-hmm. together. As I mentioned, after finding that atomic spectra would fill the A volume of some 150 or 200 pages, but actually it's a little over 200. I thought now the next thing for me to do is get the volume on molecular spectra out of the way. And I worked on that, but I found that I hadn't finished diatomic molecules, spectra of diatomic molecules, when I had already some 500 pages. And so I had to decide to divide again. And that was then divided into diatomic and polyatomic molecules. And then the same happened once again when the polyatomic book was written. It turned out it would be a book of 1,000 pages or more. And so it was split again into a book on infrared and Raman spectra, which was published in 1945, and electronic spectra in 1966. So, one of my friends tried to compare it with Richard Wagner's experience when he wrote the Nibelung Ring. He originally was going to write one opera about the death of Siegfried, and it eventually became a an introductory opera, a short opera on the Rheingold, and then three more. And I had these three with a preview in Atomic Spectra. So that wasn't my idea, but. But it sounded quite amusing.
A very good comparison. Going back a little bit, so in 1928, when you were at Göttingen, it seems to have been a really exceptional year for molecular spectra and structures. You were obviously doing the right subject at the right time and place.
That's right.
Could you say, you've already said a little about your experiences, is there anything else you'd like to add about these developments?
Well, this was 1928 was a year in which Friedrich Hund, who was a frequent visitor in Göttingen, published his basic papers on molecular orbital theory. Of course, molecular orbital theory is usually connected with the name of Robert Mulliken, but
the Hund's rule?
Hund rule, that was to be even before that. Hund rule refers really originally to atoms. But at that time in 1938, Hund published his papers applying what he had studied in connection with atoms to molecules. And he had the concept of molecular orbitals, but he didn't have the word. It's a strange situation that Mulliken, who was well aware of Hund's work and used Hund's work, but he was clever enough to produce a good word for it. And sometimes in science, it's useful to have such a word, and it's easier to work on the subject if you can refer to it in brief terms. And that is what happened to molecular orbital theory. Of course, Robert Mulliken then developed molecular orbital theory a great deal.
He was at Göttingen then?
Mulliken was not in Göttingen. No. He, I don't know whether... No, I don't think he ever came to Göttingen at that. He was in Göttingen at one time. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't there at that time, so I can't quite... I first met him, I think, while I was still in Darmstadt. No, I met him, I think, for the first time in Bristol, when I was in Bristol. Yes, that's right.
Oh, this leads us on to the next question. You had a visit from Leonard Jones to Göttingen in 1929, and... you were invited to spend a year at the University of Bristol. This was your first extended stay outside, to an English-speaking country.
That's right.
Did you find the language a problem to your research?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I had fairly good instruction at school in English. And... in fact, I thought I was doing fairly well with English because there were many American or English visitors coming around. But when I first came to England, to Bristol, there was a meeting by the Faraday Society in the first few days that I was there. And the first speaker was... what was his initial? Doesn't matter. Richardson. O.W. Richardson, a very distinguished physicist, and he also worked on molecular hydrogen, a subject that I became very much involved in. But the trouble was that he mumbled, and I couldn't understand a word of what he was saying, and I began to wonder whether I would ever have a chance to understand English. But to the second speaker in the same meeting was Professor Raman from India, who I think the following year had received the Nobel Prize for its discovery of the Raman effect, and I could understand every word he said, so I became a little more confident, and actually there were never any great problems, but it did mean that when I then had to leave Germany in 1935, I had a sufficient background of English that I was absolutely no difficulty. I could start lecturing the first day I was over here.
Mm-hmm. The majority of the research papers that you had to read and other people had to read, both in England and in Germany, were they largely German?
Pardon, the what was in
German? The papers that you had to read, you know, the current literature. Do you remember them to be?
I would say it was about 50-50 at that time.
So, in fact, you had to read a great deal
of
English. Of
English. Oh, yes, already then. Because nowadays the situation has completely switched over to English. And it's comparatively rare that I have to read a German paper. English is now 65% or 70% of the published literature in physics.
After all this
time? Or chemistry.
Yes, indeed. After all this time, do you find it easier to think in English or in German?
English. That is, if I go to Germany now, I try to avoid, not always do, lecturing in German. But somehow doesn't come out as fluently as English.
I was very interested. You said that in 1929 you found the Bristol physics department very well equipped for your purposes. Mm. I thought this was very interesting because you'd just gone from a very good university where the equipment must have been really excellent.
You mean in Göttingen?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, although... No, I would say at that time, certainly the Bristol physics department was much better supported financially than the Göttingen physics department.
Interesting.
But on the other hand, there were some very powerful minds working in Göttingen.
Yes.
And I don't think that the Bristol people could quite match that. But now you were asking about Leonard Jones. Shall I answer that now?
Yes, please do.
Leonard Jones was another one of those visitors that came along all the time. And since he was interested in molecular orbital theory, he was a theoretician. And I had was just then in the process of writing a lengthy paper on molecular orbital theory from a more experimental point of view, if you like. We had lots and lots of discussions at the time, and indeed one will find that Leonard Jones was preparing actually a summary paper on the subject for this very meeting in Bristol on molecular structure that I was attending during the first few days of my stay in Bristol. And if you compare our two papers, there's quite a similarity in the point of view. And I hate to say which was predominant. I mean, certainly Leonard Jones had some very good ideas, and he was a very clear writer. So, but I enjoyed the contacts with him. And but still, I didn't pursue my theoretical work all that much. I did have one opportunity to talk with Hund, whom I mentioned before, and he was aware of my work, but in a way he wasn't, because in his next paper he omitted a reference to my paper, which was then, by then published. But he was very, when this was pointed out to him, and moreover that one particular idea that he had stressed was actually in my paper, he was very strong in his apologies, and in his next paper made very generous amends of this oversight that he had made. And I just wrote to Hund a couple of months ago on occasion of his 90th birthday. He's still active.
In Germany?
In Germany.
Oh, okay.
Friend who visited us here last week had been at a meeting to honor Bohr's 100th birthday in Copenhagen, and Hund was there, and he was sitting right next to him, and was amazed at his vitality. So Hund is certainly still around and very much interested in physics. He has actually turned somewhat to history of physics.
I guess that's not surprising. There was something I wanted to ask you, which I guess is sort of connected with what we're talking about. And this is about the advance or the progress of instruments, how this has altered, affected your work. Would you like to talk about this now?
Yes. I don't know whether I can be very explicit, but it is obvious that advances in instrumentation are very important for the progress of science, physics, chemistry, or any other science, for that matter. And in my own field, when I was in Darmstadt as a graduate student and later as a member of the, a junior member, if you like, of the faculty, we had until about 1932 or so only prism instruments to do our spectroscopic work, which are certainly not as good or as high resolving as grating instrument. It was only then, in 32 or thereabouts, that we finally got grating instruments, and it made a great deal of difference to my work, because from that time on I was able to study the fine structure, the so-called rotational fine structure of molecular spectra, and that was the first step. Well, then gratings, of course, were improved, and photographic plates were improved. That was important for my work, particularly in connection with the study of the absorption spectrum of the atmosphere, of our atmosphere, and the discovery of so-called forbidden transitions in oxygen. And also, together with the same Dr. Spinks, who was in Darmstadt throughout 1934, in studying the rotation vibration spectra in the photographic infrared, where I think we made some fairly nice progress. So nowadays, of course, many things are done by lasers. I haven't myself done very much with lasers, but I'm using laser techniques by using modern infrared instruments which use laser techniques. And so all along, I think it's fair to say that the improvement of instrumentation is an important factor in the development of science. And of course, the development of science by itself improves instrumentation. It's an interplay between the two. And many physicists and chemists have contributed to the development of modern techniques. So it's a very important interrelation between these two things.
Have you at any stage of your work found that you were prevented from pursuing an idea because of lack of a certain item that either was not available or just did not exist?
Well, I mean, I might say that when I first came to Saskatoon, there was very little equipment there, and there was only one reasonable prism instrument, a Hilger instrument, available. And during the first 2 or 3 years that I was there, I couldn't begin to do the kind of work I wanted to do until in about, when was it now? 37 or so, I got a grant from the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia. The grant was the magnificent sum of $1,500, and that allowed me to get a grating and to build a grating spectrograph with it. And from then on, I could handle in Saskatoon structures of spectra that allowed me to discuss rotation of molecules and things of that sort. So that was one occasion. Here in Ottawa, we haven't really had this problem, because up to now, I emphasize, funding for basic science has been quite generous, and instrumental problems haven't really held us up, except for those where the instrument wasn't there yet and it had to be developed or thought about.
Could we go back to the chronology of events in your life now? You returned to Darmstadt at the end of 1929, got married.
Yes, I didn't really return to Darmstadt then. I returned in 1930. I mean, after Bristol, I went directly. Well, I mean, I stopped over in Darmstadt, but because it's not very far. But I went, in a way, directly from Göttingen to Bristol. And it was while I was in Bristol that I got married.
Oh, I see. And your wife was also a physicist, and I believe had a PhD in spectroscopy.
Yeah, her degree came just shortly before we left Darmstadt on account of the Nazis. That is, her degree must have been 1934, I would say. Yeah, it could have been beginning of 34, I'm not sure. But at any rate, her degree was based on work that was done in Darmstadt under my direction. But since we were then married, since we were then married, I wasn't the official supervisor. The PhD examination was actually held at the University of Frankfurt, where there was also a very distinguished spectroscopist, although entirely atomic spectroscopist, who later on was a good friend, who came to this continent also because he had the same trouble that I had, a Jewish wife. And but her degree was in Frankfurt, and it was just at the last moment. If she had been a few months later, she wouldn't have got the degree there because of the Nazis.
I wish there were more time to talk about her work, but you've often said that her work had helped you a lot in your research.
Well, she's helped in the scientific work that I did, and many papers are joint papers with her, and also she has helped a great deal in the first two volumes of this series, or the first three volumes, if you like, include the atomic spectra, by drafting some of the figures and tables and things of this sort.
So, at the end of your time abroad in England, what were the things that had most influenced you?
I'm sorry?
During your first year abroad in England, what were the things that most influenced you? Had you travelled, in fact, to outside Germany before then?
No, that was my first. I think it was my first trip, yes, outside Germany.
Were you surprised by anything?
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, I mean, I was certainly taken by the many very great differences between the English attitude to things in general and the German attitude to things in general, whether it's politics or what is good manners. I mean, the things differ, or how you celebrate Christmas, or everything is really quite different. But on the other hand, people are very friendly. We always found them to be, and if one only knows to do the right thing. And some people don't know that there are people who have different ideas about good manners, and they might take amiss something that you do without knowing that this isn't done in England. So, but on the whole, the difference are not all that great. And for example, much more than we never had an afternoon tea in the land in Germany. At least at that time, this may be different now. Well, in fact, I know it is. But in England, there was a very strong or consistent routine in having this tea, and they had actually one of the staff that looked after the mail and this sort of thing. They looked also after the tea, and the English tea is something very special when you are not used to it. So that was one of the lighter things that was very nice. I don't know what else I can think of in that connection. Probably think of it tomorrow night.
I guess the custom of afternoon tea is one of the better English customs.
It is, yes. It is. If it isn't too, if it doesn't go too far, I heard of one difficulty that arose with a German refugee and his wife who came to England. And no, this German refugee married an English girl, and anyway, whether it was the wife or the man himself, the mother-in-law was not very well, and they brought her up tea with various things, but they bought the wrong things, and that just wouldn't do. I mean, they broke the good relations between mother-in-law and son-in-law.
I think it's not so serious now.
It's not so serious now. No. It's strange how some customs are so firmly established that you...
Yeah, but I believe that Rutherford had some of his best ideas during these afternoon tea sessions.
Yes.
I guess it can be useful.
Yes.
So, in 1930, you returned to Darmstadt and began teaching.
Yes.
Was this a good experience, looking back?
I think so, yes. Yes. I worked fairly hard to prepare my lectures. It didn't come easy to me, but once I had prepared them, I enjoyed giving them. And I learned a great deal on the subjects that I was teaching. Of course, at first, you see, I was a Privatdozent, which means I was a private lecturer, really. And as such, I could give lectures of my own choosing, but no regular lectures. But then, when the Nazis came the first year, one of the older members of the staff of the physics department, who was Jewish, but he had been teaching theoretical physics. He wasn't really all that good in that, but he did. But then he was relieved of this teaching because the Nazis came. And I was asked to substitute for him. And that was certainly a good training for me. because I hadn't really studied theoretical physics all that well during my years as a student in Darmstadt, because there was either nothing or there was only this old Jewish professor who was a little stuck in the early years of physics, and he didn't follow the subject. He unfortunately, well, he was put into a concentration camp eventually, but Professor Rao, the same one who got him out of that under the condition that he would immediately leave the country, and he did. He went to England. But then his permission to stay in England at one stage wasn't extended. And when he got the word for that, he had a heart attack and died.
What was his name?
Beerwald. He was a good soul, but he was not a great scientist.
I guess now I'm repeating a question that I asked you earlier during your student days at Darmstadt, but now you're a lecturer and you're more mature, and you've met people like Schrödinger and Born and Frank and Wigner. Do you recall this as something of a golden age in physics, or do you think all this glow and excitement that people associate with that era
Well, I think it's quite true that in retrospect it seems more golden than it actually was. Uh-huh. But still, it was an exciting time. There's no question of that. The years, particularly the years between 1926 and 30, I mean, in 1930, if I remember correctly, that heavy hydrogen was discovered by Urey, and that was a major discovery both in chemistry and physics. And we did actually, when Dr. Spinks came over to work with me in 1933-34, the hydrogen had just been separated, heavy hydrogen. And we set up an apparatus to produce our own heavy hydrogen, where we were only partially successful. We got some, but by that time you could buy it, even though at a price, and it was much less troublesome to buy it than to make it oneself. So all this went on, and then Spinks went around Germany and Austria actually to visit some labs. He came across a physical chemist in Vienna by the name of Patat, and with him he was very good at preparing compounds containing heavy hydrogen, and on that basis we produced some work that we would otherwise not have done. So everything worked together, and it was an exciting time, right? I mean, there's no question of that.
You also met Edward Teller about this time.
That must have been, around 1932, I would think. Teller was a very bright young man at the time, and he's still bright, but he uses his brightness for purposes that I don't quite approve of. But I had quite a lot of contact with him after first meeting him at a meeting in Leipzig, where he was just getting his PhD under Heisenberg. And after that, he was interested in molecular problems, and I had some experimental knowledge on molecular problems. And we exchanged those two, and eventually in 1934 wrote a paper which was all Teller's, and all that I did was to be the midwife in getting it out of him and in writing it down. And so, but he insisted that the paper, the authors would be named in the alphabetical order, which put me first. I wanted him to be the first author, but he didn't want to hear of it. As an indication that he was a very, in many ways, a very modest man. I mean, I met him again a good deal of the time during the first years on this continent. He also came about the same time to George Washington University in Washington, D.C. And at one time I stayed actually with him there. And he often, in discussions with other people, had a very bright idea what to try, but he would never insist that he should be a co-author. So personal ambition, I don't think, is what drives Edward Teller. And I certainly have the highest respect for his scientific ability. I spent half an hour with him 3 years ago in Livermore, and we didn't talk about politics, so we got along very well.
Have you ever discussed politics with him?
I did at one time, and this is a strange point. When I was in Chicago between 1945 and 48, Teller was in Chicago, and he, as well as Mulliken, wanted to persuade me to stay in Chicago, at the University of Chicago. But the point I want to make is this, that at that time, I don't exactly remember whether it was 45, 46, or 47, Teller was traveling throughout the country lecturing on world government. And he knew all the answers to the objections to world government and all that. And was a very convincing kind of speaker. But he traveled on that theme so much that the faculty was a little worried that he was neglecting his duties as a professor at the University of Chicago. So he was, in a way, quite a different man from now.
Did you ever talk with him during the...
During that time I talked to him, yes, and he convinced me that world government is our only way out.
Very interesting. I wanted to ask you, during this time that you were in Darmstadt as a teacher, as a lecturer, did you also meet some of the chemists who were working in Germany?
Oh, yes.
Nernst, Bodenstein, Haber, Polanyi?
Yes. The old Polanyi, you mean?
Yes.
Yes.
Michael.
The father. Yes, indeed, I did. All of those that you mentioned. The person who made the greatest personal impression on me was K.F. Bonhoeffer, Karl Friedrich Bonhoeffer.
That was my next question.
He was... I knew him since about, I would say, 1928, when I was still in Darmstadt at a meeting. I had written a paper about a subject that he also had written a paper on, and I had criticized his paper naively as a young man one is. And he didn't hold it against me at all, and he was willing to discuss the problem. And
do you remember what the paper was about?
This was about the afterglow of nitrogen, which at the time was quite a puzzle, and for many years remained a puzzle. It's a very striking phenomenon, and whoever sees it is greatly tempted to investigate it further. When you send a discharge through nitrogen, you find that after you turn it off, it glows with a beautiful yellow golden color. But that's a different matter. And that goes back to around the year 1900, when it was studied by a person called Lewis, and then studied further by Strutt, who later became Lord Rayleigh. Anyway, it's a striking phenomenon, and both Bonhoeffer and I were interested in it. But at this first meeting, I met him as a really most genuine kind of person that I have ever met. Well, that's a difficult thing to say. I shouldn't quite say that that way, but one of the most genuine people that I have met. And I continued my acquaintance with him when he was taking a chair at the University of Frankfurt, which is very close to Darmstadt. And so all through those years between 1930 and 1935, I would see Bonhoeffer certainly once a year, if not more often. And he not only was a very fine scientist, he is this discoverer of ortho and parahydrogen, but he also was an extraordinarily fine person, and he was one who certainly stood up to the Nazis as well as anybody. And of course you are familiar with his brother Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a minister and who was executed by the Nazis.
Did you ever meet him?
No, I never met Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Mm.
Once before, when we were talking about this, you said that when you later met Bonhoeffer here in Ottawa, he didn't talk about his experiences.
No.
In Germany.
Yeah, he came to Ottawa. In fact, was there anything like that in the letter that Stacy wrote? I'm not quite sure, but anyway, when I looked for these letters that you had asked for, I found a letter in which Stacy mentioned the fact that Bonhoeffer might be coming here, uh-huh. And and he sent me a copy of the letter to Bonhoeffer, and he indicated that I would be very much interested in seeing him. But he did come, and then he actually stayed with us. Uh-huh. And it was quite
amazing. So you remember him to have changed very much physically, but...
Physically, yes.
But
yes.
No, he didn't talk about his experiences?
No, we didn't. But I knew, I don't know whether he told me that himself, that he was always aware of what was happening. I mean, his brother Dietrich was involved with this putsch to get rid of Hitler, and Karl Friedrich Bonhoeffer was aware all along of what was happening. Mm-hmm. Very fine family. This Bonhoeffer was a very famous psychiatrist at the University of Berlin, mm-hmm. The father Bonhoeffer.
Yes.
And but Karl Friedrich Bonhoeffer is one of, I would say, three or four people whom I consider as the most genuine people and the most for whom I have the most affectionate regard.
This makes me want to ask you at this stage about the work that chemists were doing at about the same time that we're talking about your years in Darmstadt. They were having a very difficult time with this whole concept of free radicals, proving their existence and establishing their role in reaction mechanisms. Do you remember there much to be much interaction between chemists and physicists generally that you were aware of?
Well, I think there was always a good deal of interaction between certainly physical chemists and physicists who worked in the molecular field. Of course, the physicists pretty soon went off to nuclear physics and elementary particles and left the field of molecular studies, not completely, but still so that after that the interaction didn't need to be very strong because the physical chemists had taken over. And of course that is one reason why I didn't get the prize in physics, but in chemistry. But the interaction was always there. But I do recall, as a student in Darmstadt in 1925 or thereabouts, there was a meeting of physical chemists in Darmstadt, an international meeting in physical chemistry. I don't know what it was called, but two or three of the most prominent physical chemists were there. One of them was Arrhenius, who I think was one of the first to get the Nobel Prize in chemistry. And the other was Punnett, who was the first to produce the methyl radical. And they gave lectures. I have no very clear recollection of the lectures. I seem to remember having met Arrhenius just very briefly. Punnett, I do remember that he gave a lecture, but I don't remember actually having met him at that time. Mm-hmm. But that, of course, I remembered when I worked myself on the spectrum of the methyl radical.
Mm-hmm. I would like to press you a little bit more on this a little bit later on, but if we go back now to the chronology of your life, in 1933, two events which were oddly connected occurred. You had a visit from a young Canadian physical chemist, John Spates, whom you've already mentioned, and who would play a role in bringing you to Canada. And also in that year, the Nazis came to power. Could you say a little bit about your life at this time and your decision to leave Germany?
Well, I mean, to most intellectual people, shall I say, the advent of the Nazis was a terrible experience in view of their fantastic ideas about the Jews and all that. And well, as soon as I remember, for example, when at the beginning of the Nazi regime in April 1933, that was just the time when I was collaborating with Edward Teller on this paper, joint paper that we were writing. And then it appeared in the newspapers that James Franck had resigned, although he was not directly affected by the legislation because he had served in the first war on the front, and that was a condition that he would be exempted from being fired. But he said that he didn't want to make use of this exemption because what about his children? They would be considered as second-class citizens in the country, and so he resigned and indeed soon afterwards left the country. And I remember writing a very strong letter to Edward Teller that what I felt about this. Edward Teller, of course, was also affected. I myself was not affected more than by what happened at the university and so on for a while. But the anti-Jewish laws that the Nazis had became worse and worse as time went on. And in 1934, it became pretty obvious that people who had been married to Jews would also be in trouble. And so I began to look out for some opportunity, but didn't really get very far. The point was that when the first wave of refugees came out, they naturally got most of the jobs that were at all acceptable, and the people who left later had to put up with what was left, which wasn't very much. Well, I was lucky from two points of view. First of all, John Spinks was working with me, and that's another interesting story, but let's not bother about it right now. He had come to Darmstadt to work with me for a year, and of course that when he left, when he returned to Canada, to Saskatoon, it was obvious that I impressed on him the need for me to leave, and therefore he should try and see whether there are any opportunities. But he tried, for example, in Toronto to persuade the people that they should give me a place to work and live, but their position was that they had many people who had taken their PhD in Toronto who didn't have jobs. They were the first responsibility, and so they couldn't find any job for me. Well, when he came back to Saskatoon toward the end of 34, I think that must have been, he made a little bit of propaganda on my behalf in Saskatoon. And then it happened, and that is the second piece of good luck, that the Carnegie Foundation of New York established a fund specifically for refugees who would be able to go to Commonwealth universities, that is Australia or Canada or a few other places, and that they would offer the university who was willing to take them 2 years' salary, and it was $2,250, if I remember it correctly. 2 years' salary, with the understanding that the university at the end of those 2 years would seriously consider whether they couldn't offer this man a more permanent job. Well, I pointed this out to Dr. Spinks. He pointed it out to the president of the university, and although even the president of the university had tried to get me into Toronto, where there was a lot of spectroscopy going on, when this didn't have any result, he was willing to take me on. And yeah, that the real luck came. I mean, so I could go to Saskatoon for 2 years. Well, when I came there, one of the staff members was on leave, and it turned out that after a couple of months that he was resigning from his job because he had taken a job in Glasgow in Scotland, where he came from. And so there was an open position, and they had tried me out for 3 months, and the president offered me the job, and I was well set. I didn't have to worry about the future anymore. So with these pieces of luck, I was well set. I mean, of course, there were not much in the matter of equipment in Saskatoon, and not we didn't even give a PhD degree at that time at the university, so that students were limited. They left when they had their master's degree, if they stayed that long, and so not much help from students in doing research, although there was some. But anyway, everything turned out very well, and I look back with considerable nostalgia to those days in Saskatoon.
I'm interested to know something, just being talking about how you came to Canada, to Saskatoon. But during your year in Bristol, you visited a number of other universities and made a number of contacts with British scientists like Blackett and Oliphant and John Cockcroft. Many German scientists ended up in England during the war.
Ended up?
In England.
In England.
Did you ever consider going to Cambridge, for example, or?
Well, I would have loved to go to Cambridge, but no offer was forthcoming. I mean, at the time I visited Cambridge, that was in 1929.
Right.
And there was no reason for me to angle for a job in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And I, after spending a year in Bristol, I was pretty sure that they wouldn't want a German physicist or spectroscopist in Cambridge. It didn't seem worth trying. But I hadn't also, I mean, I didn't really intend to leave Germany.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in fact, when the time came in 1933-34, the connections really which loomed very large were with Canada. So there were fewer.
Well, no, I had one or two other possibilities because there were two organizations that looked after refugees. There was one in England, the International Assistance Council, or what was it called? I can't remember the exact name. And in there was another group in Zurich called Notgemeinschaft Deutscher Wissenschaftler im Ausland, which was a very similar organization. I didn't, of course, during the Nazi time, go to England, but I did go to Switzerland, to Zurich, to find out what could be done. And they had been in touch with me. And indeed, this information about the possibility of a grant from the Carnegie Foundation of New York came through me via one of these two organizations. I can't remember which one. But they also offered me two other jobs. One job was in the Soviet Union, and I'm quite happy that I didn't bite for that one. Indeed, it was the same place. I had, during my Göttingen year, I met a Russian physicist by the name of Rumer, very interesting person, who was a theoretical physicist and a friend of Heitler, and they wrote a couple of papers together. And through this connection, I was invited to go to Kharkov in the Ukraine. In about 1932 I was invited, and I was to go in 1933 to Kharkov. Well, when the Nazis came, this immediately fell by the wayside. Well, there was a possibility of a job in Kharkov as a refugee, but not many of the refugees really lived through. I mean, some of the refugees went there, and I remember one very distinguished spectroscopist who went to Soviet Union and was never heard of again. So that was one. The other one was in Belgium, in Ghent, which was a small university, but I went there to be interviewed, and I found it quite nice. But when this affair in Canada arose, it seemed, I don't know whether I realized that Belgium would be invaded by the Nazis, but at any rate, the opportunity was certainly better, because in Ghent I would have had a very low assistantship. So I didn't consider it further when the Carnegie Award from through Canada came through.
So you decided to take up the Canadian offer, and in 1935 you and your wife left Germany to go to the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon, you managed to take some spectroscopic equipment with you.
Yes.
This was very far-sighted. Please tell me a bit more.
Well, at the time, it was impossible to take more than 10 marks, which at that time was $2.50 per person along.
U.S.?
Yeah, I actually did, yes. But you could take furniture or other things. Now, we didn't have any furniture because we were living in rooms, but I had saved some money and also got some money from my father-in-law, who was still in Germany at the time. And we could buy some equipment, and which we did, and that was used to build an instrument in Saskatoon. Not a very big instrument, but still it was useful to have at the time. It wasn't, I mean, the total value of what we took out was perhaps something of the order of, was certainly not more than $500. That is not $1935. I think it was less than that, because we didn't really have that much money, but I'm not sure what happened to the instrument that we built, but it must be still in Saskatoon.
Did you have to leave in 1935? Did you have to leave and pack in great hurry?
No. Well, first of all, I didn't perhaps say explicitly that in about 1934, the university told me that I wouldn't be my contract wouldn't be renewed. You see, I was earning a living as an assistant. I was not earning a living as a Privatdozent. That was not worth talking about, what I got for being a Privatdozent. So, but this assistantship was discontinued as of October 1935, so I had to find something. But when this came through with the, they called it guest lectureship at the Carnegie Foundation, because it was not a permanent job, and so they called it guest lectureship. So when I told the authorities I was going to Canada, packed our things, and they had to be investigated, you know, and the particular customs officer or whatever he was took it very easy, and there was no comment on taking a few scientific pieces of equipment along, particularly since I was going on a guest professorship and spreading the rumor of Germany. They thought German, how should I call it, German habits and German science to other countries, you know.
At that time, there was no objection with the government, the German.
No, apparently, no, there was no objection, except for the fact that we were tied by the rule of the 10 marks, that is $2.50.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, fortunately, the university in Saskatoon had arranged that we would get some money when we landed. I mean, it was naturally by boat.
Mm-hmm. Who paid for the fare?
We could pay the fare.
Oh.
Indeed, we paid for a return fare. Not that we may even have thought that in 1 or 2 years this whole thing will be over, but also to have something that we could then later sell if possible.
Mm-hmm.
So we paid for the return fare. That was possible still.
Did your brother stay in Germany?
My brother stayed in Germany, yes. Because he was not affected, because it didn't go that far that the sister-in-law would count as an argument against you.
Not yet, anyway. I mean, at the time.
So on your way from Germany to Saskatoon, you stopped off at Princeton.
Oh, yes. Incidentally, we paid not only the boat trip to New York, but also the whole trip from New York to Saskatoon in advance. So that much we could do with the money that we had, in the German money we had.
That's a good thing. So you stopped off in New York and visited Princeton.
Yes, I visited Princeton, I visited Chicago, I visited, actually on my way I also visited McGill University, and quite a number of other, oh yes, I visited in University of Illinois because there was a very prominent molecular physicist by the name of F.W. Loomis who had invited me to drop by, and then what else? Well, Ohio I think I went to. I don't really remember all the places that I did visit, but there must have been about a dozen places that I visited on the way, because I didn't think I would come back all that soon, because it was a long way and with a modest salary and it wouldn't be so easy to travel.
Mm-hmm. This was your first trip to the United States?
Yes, yes.
Can you remember any of the first impressions?
Not really. I mean, everything is so different. And again, it's different in Canada from what it is in the United States. That no, I really don't think that I could remember very much.
So now you've arrived in Saskatoon, in Saskatchewan, and your years there were very productive despite the obvious lack of equipment. Is there anything now, looking back, that you would like specifically to recall?
Well, the university, of course, was a very small university at that time, and there were some only 1,200 students and 100 faculty members, and of course you met all the faculty members very shortly after you arrived. So it was a very personal thing, and they were very friendly and tried to make things easy for us. So I look back on these days in Saskatoon, as I say, with great pleasure, and it was a nice time. If only the war hadn't come.
Was it difficult to be a German scientist during the war?
Not in Saskatoon, no. No, not at all. At first I had to report to the police once a month or this kind of thing, but it was very very pleasant is the wrong expression, but they were very nice. And later on I actually did some war research work on explosives, and then I had to travel to the United States, and for that of course I needed a passport or something like it, and my German passport of course wouldn't be very useful. So they provided eventually a special document in lieu of a passport, and then I could travel to the United States to go to various meetings on these things. There's one interesting occurrence, perhaps, at the time when the United States entered the war, no, before they entered the war. I was at a meeting in Chicago or somewhere, I can't remember. And of course one went at that time by rail. And when I wanted to return to Saskatoon, the Nazis had invaded Holland and Belgium, and the American government decided to close the boundaries of the country against all enemy aliens. And of course, technically, I was an enemy alien. And so when I tried to go back to Saskatoon via Winnipeg, on the way from between Minneapolis and Winnipeg, a place, I don't remember the name anymore. That's strange. Anyway, in my memory, I remembered quite well. I was taken off the train as not being able to leave the country. And the particular immigration officer was a very kind old man, and he tried to explain. But it took about 3 days to get this straightened out. And this old man, told me that, I mean, he said he wouldn't want to put me in a proper cell so that I couldn't get out. But if I were to escape and go across the border by just walking around, he would lose his job. Well, naturally, I didn't attempt to.
So where did they put you during the 3 days?
Well, they had two or three rooms on the border, in the border office of the immigration and customs people, where they could lock up people, but they didn't lock me up.
You volunteered.
Yeah.
So during the war, then, you were not forbidden to make contact with other scientists anywhere?
No, not at all. Mm-hmm. Not at all. Mm-hmm.
And in effect, you carried on with your work at the university, your teaching.
That's
and
right.
Your research.
I had more of a teaching load at that time because some of the regular faculty members were involved in teaching younger military people in radio and things of that sort, you know. And indeed, I was also used my knowledge of German, because they had to have taught the later part of the war. They had to have people to send over who knew some German. The strange thing was that there are many people of German origin in Western Canada, and they wanted naturally to go into this kind of job, and I had to examine them. But I found that the people who were of German origin, their German was not as good as some of the others who had really studied it. So I had something to do with that also.
Mm-hmm. In the meantime, did you get any news from home?
Any news? No. No, I didn't get any word from my brother and his family during all those years.
Mm-hmm. Just a very brief mention of some of the work that you did at Saskatoon during these years. I was very interested in your mentioning about this discovering the shorting of bonds in methyl acetylene.
Oh, yes.
And Pauline evidently didn't believe you.
That's right.
That seems a very interesting.
Well, this was really some work that was still done just before I left Germany, and together, I forget now, I think John Spinks was involved in it also, and this man Patat I mentioned earlier was involved, and I contributed this paper to a meeting in Princeton, actually.
And Pauline was there?
No, Pauline was not there, and there was no argument about this paper. But then, later on, I found out that Pauline hadn't believed this result and had got a person whom I knew from Göttingen by the name of Badger to repeat the experiment. And sure enough, he got the same results. And then Pauline believed.
Did you correspond with him on this?
I didn't ever correspond with Pauline on this, no. I've corresponded with Pauline later on, more recently. Connection with some of the Soviet dissidents and all that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I guess his book hadn't appeared then. That was 1939. His book.
No. You mean Pauling's book?
Yes. That was 39.
Was it 39? Then that could be, yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the other point which comes to mind is that your work around this time appeared to concentrate more and more on the application of spectroscopy to astrophysics.
Uh-huh.
So in a way, both your earlier interest, well, your earliest interest was now being combined with your work. Well, did you engineer this, or was this a natural development?
I think it was a natural development. I mean, because I was interested in astrophysical problems, people knew that. They sometimes came to me with problems, spectroscopic problems. And one of the most significant was when Professor Swings of the University of Liège in Belgium asked me what I thought of a spectrum that appears in comets. And I looked at the spectrum a good deal and trying to find what it could be, and I had just written volume 2, and so I thought I was clever in saying that it was due to CH2, which in fact it wasn't. It was only much later here in Ottawa that I observed the real spectrum of CH2, but the spectrum that Swings had called to my attention then was later on identified as being due to triatomic carbon. But the other astronomical result, which was perhaps at that time at any rate more important, was the identification of a number of sharp lines that were observed in interstellar space. And we had a meeting actually in at the Yerkes Observatory. This was in 1937, I would say. And I attended this meeting, and Edward Teller was there, Robert Mulliken was there, Stuber, of course, I think Swings himself was also there, and we debated what this could be. Mulliken had suggested that these lines could be due to CH2 again, which was incorrect, but Teller and I got together and discussing this, and we decided it must be CH+. And when I came back from this trip to the United States, I had a very good graduate student with me, Alec Douglas, and he had just the right kind of apparatus ready, and we put some gas in there, some benzene vapor, and within a few days we had the proof that the spectrum really was due to CH+. Now that, for many years, was the only molecular iron that had been observed in the interstellar space, and since only two other molecules at the time had been seen, that was CN and CH, it was a fairly significant contribution to the development of the subject of interstellar space. And it was on that score that the director of the Yerkes Observatory offered me a job at the Yerkes Observatory.
This was in 1943.
Yes, the offer came in 43, but at that time I couldn't leave the country because of manpower regulations that scientific people couldn't leave the country. And then when the war was ended, I got permission to leave, and so I took on that job.
So that was in 1945.
That was in 45, that's right.
You weren't there very long, just from 45 to 49?
48.
What do you think, looking back, were the most productive outcome of your stay there?
The 3 years? Well, the most important, undoubtedly, was the observation of the quadrupole spectrum of hydrogen. Well, I had built at Yerkes Observatory a long absorption tube of a type that had not been built before. I had the advantage. At the Yerkes Observatory was an optician who formerly worked with Michelson, a famous optical scientist, and he prepared a set of mirrors for me that allowed me, in a cube that was 75 feet long, to send light back and forth up to 200 or 250 times. So I got a very long absorbing path, and with that I studied a number of other molecules, but the most important one from my point of view was the study of the molecular hydrogen. And I feel still proud of the fact that I did eventually observe, just before I left Chicago, a number of quadrupole lines of hydrogen. They became rather important much later in astronomy. I didn't know it at that time. Well, no, it was an astronomical problem that had stimulated me to try to find these quadrupole lines, and that was the detection of hydrogen in planetary atmospheres, the atmospheres of Jupiter and the outer planets, because it had long been suggested by astronomers that there was a lot of hydrogen, but nobody had been able to prove it. And this was going to prove it, but it took 10 years after my discovery to actually do this, and to actually obtain this proof by some of the astronomers who took spectra of planetary atmospheres. But moreover, in addition to that, quite unexpectedly, you might say, quadrupole spectrum of hydrogen was found in emission in interstellar space, in, for example, the Orion molecular cloud, because in this cloud there are shock waves which excite hydrogen, and the density is so low that the time between collisions becomes of the order of the lifetime of the molecule in the excited state. Maybe not quite that, but at any rate long enough so that one can see this quadrupole spectrum. And that was about 1975 for the first time that it was observed, and gave me a great deal of pleasure, even though I had nothing to do with the observation. I was still the first to have observed in the laboratory the spectrum, the quadrupole spectrum of molecular hydrogen.
I'm very familiar with the next event in your life, which was that in 1947 you received an invitation from the National Research Council in Ottawa, specifically from EWR Stacey, to set up a spectroscopy lab with all kinds of enticing promises regarding equipment and promises of minimal administrative duties. How did you feel about returning to Canada? Were you pleased at the prospect?
Yes, I was certainly pleased at the prospect. There were a number of things that I didn't particularly like in the United States, and you might say one item that gave additional impetus to my desire to go back was when the Office of Naval Research was formed soon after the war. Applications were invited from university people for grants for research, and it was suggested to me that I should apply by the director of the observatory, and it turned out that my application was turned down. Many other people did get research grants from the Office of Naval Research and still do. Well, I began to ask myself, maybe I'm not in the wrong place, but this is not the decisive point by any means, but generally I felt that while I really originally wanted to be an astronomer, to live only amongst astronomers was not really quite what I expected. I needed the contact of chemists and physicists, and therefore, and of course I could have gone to the campus of the University of Chicago, I was invited to do so, but life in Chicago didn't seem to me very attractive, and still doesn't. And in fact, I still wonder why my friend Oka, who was a member of our staff for 10 years, finally chose to go to the University of Chicago. Well, the point, of course, is there are some very distinguished people at the campus, and very bright people to associate with, and that's all very nice, but living in Chicago is not what I would like to do, and I didn't at the time. Of course, my friends, my American friends, seemed to think that how could I possibly go back to living in an igloo? And it was almost expressed in that way. A good friend of mine, who was actually of Dutch background, well, of Dutch, was born in Holland. And
we should also mention that your two children were born in Canada, so we're born Canadian.
That had an effect also. Mm. But perhaps the strongest impression that contributed to our going back to Canada was when we lived in Saskatoon throughout the war, there was no black market. Absolutely no black market that we could detect. I mean, we didn't go out to detect the black market, but we never encountered it. The moment we came down to this place, Williams Bay, where the observatory is, small place, there was black market all over the place. And that is somehow frightened us. And that, I think, had a fair amount to do with going back to Canada.
Mm-hmm. But just in passing, what about the kind of equipment you had at the observatory? Did you have everything you wanted?
Well, there was another, that was in a way another problem. Of course, everything had to be obtained. I mean, the observatory budget was not all that strong, but I did build up a spectrograph and a spectroscopic laboratory, and that part went fairly well, but there were limits, and that's why I was to apply for funds from the Office of Naval Research, which didn't work out. So I would now have to try some other place to get funds. And one of the really attractive things at NRC at that time, and how it would be today, I don't know, but at that time was that I didn't have to make any application for research funds. They were there.
We come to the next point about your return to Canada. You came to the National Research Council in Ottawa, and Dr. Stacey, who subsequently became president of the NRC, was a great believer in the freedom of research and the minimum amount of bureaucracy. Just for those who have never heard about Dr. Stacey's methods for achieving these in a government laboratory, could you say a little bit about how this philosophy has affected your own methods of working after you became director of the physics division, which was in 1949?
Well, it certainly did, because he was, as you said, a great believer in the freedom of the research worker to do what he wants to do, come at hours that he wants to come at. If somebody insisted on working at night, that was all perfectly all right with Dr. Stacey. The one thing I learned from him very, very strongly was that if you want to run a good physics division, a division of geophysics that I had later, you have to give the people you pick freedom to do what they want to do. That is, a director of such a division is not there to direct the people. His job is, he said, to find good people and then let them do what they think is best for them to do. And this philosophy is very hard to sell to our politicians, but it's the only philosophy that really will give all the possibilities to a creative individual that could lead to very striking developments. And the moment that the government or the organization prescribes what a person should do, a good person, a creative person, then he takes the best chance of leading. And we've had one such case in Dr. Oka, who's one of our most creative scientists. Well, nobody told him what to do. There were other reasons, but he wanted to contact with students and this sort of thing, at least that's what he told me. But the leaving of one creative person from a lab is a very serious affair, very serious. And if you make life unpleasant for the people working on basic research, then you lose the background and the initiative and for creative work in the subject that is the only kind of work that will do the later applications any good. Not that I'm not defending that you should do basic research only on account of the applications. I think that's all wrong. We do basic research for the same reason that people write poems or write music or paintings.
This prompts me to ask you something which is connected about events you hear at the NRC. Originally, the physics division had both a pure and applied section, which in 1955 were deliberately separated into two divisions, again as a direct result of Dr. Stacey's personal philosophy. I remember you saying you were personally against this break between the pure and applied research people.
Yes.
Would you care to elaborate?
Well, my feeling was that there was enough exchange between the pure people in pure physics and those in applied physics, that was something that should be maintained. But what actually happened was that plans were drawn up for a new building for applied physics only, and I wasn't told about it, actually, and I was supposed to be the director of the whole physics division. At that point, I went to Dr. Stacey and told him, well, this can't go on. I mean, either I am the director of the division or I'm not. And he immediately saw the point. But I don't know whether I should blame it on Dr. Stacey, but I always say, I mean, even great people, even great administrators make mistakes. And this, I feel, was one mistake that Dr. Stacey made, that he let this happen without informing me, for one thing, and even it shouldn't have happened at all, because there's enough contact, and that contact would be lessened if the two subdivisions were separated in space.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's certainly a troubling aspect of Dr. Stacey's presidency. But the other thing I wanted to ask is, Dr. Stacey instigated the tradition of having postdoctoral fellows here at the NRC in 1948, and this brought fellows from all over the world to Ottawa. So instead of the graduate students you would have had if you'd stayed in an academic institution, you had more senior workers already qualified come to you. How does this affect your own work?
Well, I think it was an extremely good idea, and of course the physics division, when I took over, immediately started with the same system, and we had, I would imagine we had something like 100 postdoctoral fellows in the course of these years. And I think they certainly contributed a great deal to the work of the division or the group with which they were associated. And I would certainly do it the same way over again. But you could argue students are little more useful to a professor than postdoctoral fellows are to a research director, in that if the research director is sensible, he will not necessarily direct those postdoctoral fellows. If they are really good, let them do what they want to do. That's very good for the postdoctoral fellows, not too good for the director. He doesn't get any work done that way. But I still think, as I say, I would do the same thing over again, because I feel it's more important that really good people are supported, and that not so good people you take on and teach them how to do good work. So I'm all for it, but I only point out that there are some points that are not all that good for the person who still wants to maintain, in spite of administrative responsibilities, wants to maintain his own scientific work. He needs a helper. Mm-hmm. I had, for example, one of the postdocs, I won't mention any names, I decided I need somebody who works directly with me. And I chose one of our postdoctoral fellows. He was a very good man. He was too good for the job. When I suggested a topic, he went ahead and did the job. Well, when I'm good, then it's no longer my job, my work. I want to have some work of my own that I can say, this I did. So there's the problem.
But this is an interesting point. How did you largely overcome this? When you had an idea for a specific problem, how did you overcome
it? Well, one way of overcoming it was one that helped me greatly, and that was through Dr. Stacy again that I got that. He came in one day and said, I have here a letter from Professor Almond in the King's College, London. And he has a technician there who, for some family reason, wants to come to Canada. He considers him one of the best technicians. Are you interested? He asked Dr. Stacy. And Dr. Stacy asked me, are you interested, meaning me? And I was. And I got this man, and he turned out to be a real winner. That is, he replaced my hands. I never got my hands dirty anymore, unfortunately, in the lab. I mean, that is the pleasures of doing an experiment I had to give up. But it was still my experiment, because I did all the thinking about it. He did some thinking too about how to do it and so on, but it was still my experiment, and therefore I could, with good conscience, put my name to it.
Just out of interest, how would you go about planning an idea and an experiment together?
Together with another scientist
with,
or another?
With your technician, Mr. Shu. I believe his name was Mr.
Shu. Mr. Shu Smith, yes. Well, I mean, we would perhaps sit together. I mean, I had some idea what I wanted to do and had an idea how to do it, and I presented this thought to him and said, and he would have a suggestion saying, well, this surely won't work, or this surely wouldn't work. Couldn't you do it this way? Would that do also?
But he was not trained in spectroscopy.
He was not?
He was not trained in spectroscopy, so...
No, I mean, he got a lot of experience. Mm-hmm. And I have a person like that now. And it's all right. And so...
So basically, you would come up with an idea and you would present him with perhaps... a rough drawing or something,
yeah,
of
right.
Something you wanted,
and he would look after how to get it through the shop. Right? He might have to make up a more detailed drawing and this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he would do the actual experiment.
Uh-huh.
I still remember the most important, I don't know whether I told you the story before, but, when I finally found the spectrum of methylene, which was one of the most important items in the Nobel Award. It happened one day. We had been searching for 14 years 14 years. And Mr. Shoesmith came up to me and said, I have another spectrum downstairs in the dark room. Do you want to see it? I said, I'm terribly busy and I don't know whether I can. And he said to me, you must see it. And that was it. He had realized that there was something there. And I had one look at it and I knew that that was it. Now, but that's how close we were.
How many years did you work?
We worked together for 20 years. He retired, unfortunately. Well, his time for retirement had come, and he didn't want an extension, and perhaps it was wise for him because he died of cancer about, well, it must be almost 20 years now.
So it wasn't too long after he retired.
Yeah.
Now that you're here in Ottawa, the war is over, did you find making contacts again with the scientists in Europe or anywhere around the world, did you find this then a very easy matter? Did things settle down into peacetime?
Yeah, I think that was very easy. As far as most of Europe is concerned, it was a little more difficult with the eastern countries. But even that became possible, and I've been from the Soviet Union a number of times.
What was the greatest difference that you noticed after the war in your field? Did you notice a very distinct shift of, say, workers from what was, say, the centers of science in Germany to the United States? Did you find a very definite change after the war, events that had taken place during the war?
You mean that something had happened during the war that made them shift in
yes.
the field or in the actual in their attitude?
Well, both. What were the greatest changes that you noticed that happened because of the war in science?
Well, I don't really quite know what to say to that question. I mean, there were people who had been affected by the Nazis in some way or other, and one tried to avoid them. But as far as science was concerned, I don't think there was any real difference, except that, of course, in those 5 or 6 years, science had changed. The first trip I made to Europe was in 1950. That is, after coming here, after 2 years being here, I went for the first time. And I don't even remember what places I visited, but certainly I was in England, I was in Germany, and Sweden, I think. Well, I mean, Sweden at the time and even now is fairly strong in molecular spectroscopy, so I had a very interesting time there. There were also then the international meetings, like the International Union, at various committees, and these committees, I served on some of the committees, and that was interesting.
I didn't phrase the question very well, but you said science had changed, and this is what I meant to ask. It had changed. But what were the changes that you noticed? Was it in terms of the equipment or people's attitudes towards...
Well, I mean, you might say in terms of equipment, because, I mean, just take one example. During the war, microwaves were developed. And it was only after the war that the whole field of microwave spectroscopy was developed. people like Wright Wilson at Harvard and Charlie Towns and many others who were during the war doing war research on communications by means of microwaves, now use their knowledge to do scientific work with it. And I think that was a tremendous stimulus to everybody in the field, and something was developed that practically did not exist. There was one single paper on something that you could call microwave spectroscopy before the war, one single paper. All the rest of microwave spectroscopy, which is one of the most wide field now, was done after the war. And indeed, the development of the maser and laser originated from this search. And I mean, again, one can see that applied things that are extremely useful, like the laser, that originate out of pure research. I mean, well, it originated, if you like, from microwave communications, but the microwave spectroscopy was something that had nobody had in mind to do something practical with that. It,
mm-hmm.
It's still something practical did develop.
Mm-hmm. I would just like to ask you a little bit about your work at the end, so we'll skip a few years. In 1971, during a visit to the Soviet Union, it was then that you were informed you had been awarded the Nobel Prize for chemistry. I've been told that when you heard this news, you said, oh, there must be a mistake because I'm a physicist. Is this an apocryphal tale?
No, it's the other way around.
Oh.
I was surprised that it was... when I was first told about it, I was told it was in physics.
I see.
And that surprised me.
I see.
Well, I didn't explicitly say to the person who told me it must be a mistake. No, I didn't go that far. But I, in my own mind, I was surprised, because if I had done anything of considerable interest worth a Nobel Prize, it was in the borderline between physics and chemistry, and something that chemists were more interested in is than physicists. And so I was surprised, and it was only I went from Leningrad all by myself in a day coach from Leningrad to Moscow one that afternoon on the 2nd of November of that year. And here I was puzzling, now how could it be that the physics committee would give me the prize? That just didn't seem possible. Well, when I came to the end of the trip, there was a message from NRC, from the president of NRC, congratulating me on the prize in chemistry. And then everything became clear.
I'm glad we cleared that one up. Your association with NRC has been very long and very happy. Am I right in saying?
Yes, it certainly has been.
And they created the Hertzberg Institute in your honor. In 1984, for your 80th birthday, they brought together quite a galaxy of scientists to lecture in your honor. I'm glad they invited a few chemists like Henry Talby and Melvin Kelvin, in addition to all the physicists. Was this occasion kept a secret from you, or did you know about it beforehand? Did you have a hand in choosing the speakers?
I did not have a hand in choosing the speakers.
I see.
No.
Did you know about the occasion before?
Yes. I mean, it was not sprung as a big surprise to me, but I mean, at a fairly late stage, should I say. I wouldn't want to have worried about whom to invite and
no.
all that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think I was asked in one or two cases whether I knew this person or would like to see him for the meeting or this
mm-hmm.
kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Only one or two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was this a very pleasant occasion?
Oh, I think it was
you?
Most pleasant affair. The only trouble was that the very day of the dinner, that is the second day of the meeting, the cuts for NRC were announced. And that was not quite so pleasant.
I would like to just talk a little bit about that aspect of your work. So before turning to something a bit more scientific in your life, could we just mention a few of your other interests? You're very interested in music, and I understand mountaineering, not something you can do very easily around Ottawa.
No. Well, I shouldn't perhaps call it mountaineering. Mountain hiking is a better expression for it. I mean, I have done in the 60s, I have climbed three mountains in the immediate neighborhood of this place that we go to during the summer vacation, and we'll be going to this coming July, which are more than 4,000 meters high. So they're not trivial mountains, but there was some climbing, some mountaineering in that we put on crampons and this kind of stuff. Yes. I don't do that anymore, but I'm still doing mountain hiking.
Well, tell us a little bit more about your interest in music.
Well, I've always been interested in music. In fact, my brother was a musician, and one of my friends at school time, at high school, was quite a good piano player, and they often played with four hands Beethoven symphonies, all the symphonies. So I have, and I kept my interest in music, but yes, I also learned to play the violin when I was a youngster, but I had to give that up when I started university work. And it was only in 1945, after I finished my volume 2, that I decided I need now something that I can really do with pleasure, and that it should not be a chore, as if writing a book is. And I decided to take lessons in singing, and the more I did so, the more I enjoyed it, and the more I enjoyed Schubert songs and Brahms. And Brahms I started fairly late in the game, and I enjoyed Mozart and Verdi, and so I've done a fair amount without addressing the public that way. But I've only given one, or taken part in one concert where people had to pay. That was here at the Jewish Community Center, where they performed a well-known oratorio by Handel. As one gets older, memory becomes a problem. I can't remember it right now.
Was this here in Ottawa?
Here in Ottawa. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now that you've appeared as a public performer, did you enjoy the experience?
Yes, I did. I performed also at a physics meeting in Vancouver, where they wanted to give a concert of physicists, and I took part in that together with my friend, the late Harry Welsh, who was a pianist, and I did some singing, and I enjoyed that. And then I had, the people from the Fifth Estate, and they interviewed me, insisted that there should also be some singing, and I obliged them.
Oh, splendid.
So that was public, if you like.
I won't keep you long enough for that tonight. So,
I just had a session this afternoon with an accompanist.
Oh.
Well, earlier this afternoon, I should say. Remember, I skipped my lunch for that one.
I see. Oh, I really shouldn't keep you long then. Oh, I should have brought my tape recorder around. So you've never ceased your research after you...
No.
After you officially retired.
I never retired.
You never retired. Oh, you never officially retired.
Not yet.
I'm still
on the full payroll of NRC.
But you have a special title now.
Yes, I have a special title.
Which in fact goes from the time when you were supposed to retire.
It goes back to the time when I was supposed, when I would have retired if I had followed the rule. But this is one thing you might say that I got out of getting the prize, that they never wanted me to retire. So far.
Do you allow yourself a little bit more leisure time now?
Slightly, perhaps. Slightly. I mean, I don't work quite as hard for reasons of health.
But you come to the lab every day?
I come to the lab every day, yes.
Something I've always wanted to ask people born on Christmas Day, do you always end up just getting one set of presents? Do you just have one celebration?
I was very upset when I was a small boy about this particular problem. It doesn't bother me now.
But it still happens.
People are now more aware of it, I think. But as a boy, it happened all too many times, and I was really upset.
Turning to something a bit more serious, you, as a scientist, you've had a very unusual role. You've taken on sometimes the role of debating with senators and government ministers who are more inclined to science policy than science. This borderline between politics and science has made your name very well known to people who are not perhaps interested in science as such. And you've also been on the borders of political statements when you've been discussed in the support of Soviet dissidents and Soviet scientists.
Yes.
This has probably taken up a lot of time.
It does take more time than you might think, because I'm not sufficiently articulate to express it except when it's really necessary and when it doesn't come easy to me.
Have these developments in recent years surprised yourself? Have these developments surprised you?
No, not really. I mean, I was always aware that our politicians and the general public have really no understanding of basic research or its importance by itself. The best that you can get out of them is support basic research, because eventually it always turns out to be useful. But to support science, well, they do support astronomy. Well, even that is not so sure that the present government and the Nielsen Task Force, because they say don't want to support the Art Center Orchestra and all this kind of thing. At least that is talk about that. To me, sounds like a terrible thought to demolish something that has been first rate just because of some preconceived idea about what should be done by people who don't know. But at any rate, I was aware that when I talked to non-scientists, the impression they have of science is only if it's useful, it's any good. That's the wrong attitude to science.
I guess the audiences that we might have in the United States will not be familiar with some of the developments that you've been concerned with in the period from about 1968 onwards. I guess there isn't time really to talk much about this, merely to say that from about 1968 onwards there have been problems in funding for pure research in Canada, and you have been a very prominent speaker on behalf of science.
Yeah, but not a very efficient one, not a very successful one, should I say. I mean, I see it in the attitude. I mean, the previous government didn't understand basic science, and the present government doesn't understand basic science. So what have I done? I mean, I made my stand, but they never come and ask me, what do you think about this?
Oh, I'm sure they get to hear about it from the press, though.
From the press, I have been interviewed by the press any number of times.
Well, do you personally believe that freedom of science will survive?
I'm not sure of that. I hope so, but I'm not sure of that, no. Because bureaucracy is increasing all the time. And eventually, I fear that it will completely negate the freedom of science. And then, of course, there are people that say that scientists are responsible for this and that. Well, that may be true in some instances, but most of the time, what scientists develop is something that may or may not be applicable, but nobody knows the answer. As I said before, when microwaves were studied and the maser was invented by Charlie Townes, he didn't know that it would be something useful. He invented it because he wanted to study a basic problem in the reaction, in the interaction between light and matter. And the same with a laser. And as long as people don't realize that, they won't get the real truth from science.
And this is, I guess, an international situation.
It is an international situation, yes.
Concern.
But it's more or less so in different countries. I mean, in Germany, the Minister of Science in Germany, for example, emphasized at every turn that they want to support basic science, and they have a far higher percentage of basic science supported by the German government than we have. Far higher. Mm-hmm. And the same in Japan, in spite of evidence to the contrary.
Interesting. Turning back to more scientific matters, the two questions I wanted to ask you, I guess we have covered them to some degree during our conversation, which was largely about the progress of instruments. Mm-hmm. I think we can, unless there's something else you'd like to say. The other thing I was going to say is we don't have to review your work because this is all in the literature, but I guess the best known discoveries associated with your work has been the CH3 and the CH2 radicals,
yes,
and perhaps the ammonium radical. I wondered which of your own work, which of your own discoveries have given you personally the most satisfaction.
That's like asking me which of your children you like best.
Oh, I see.
I have only two children, so.
So you, in effect, were excited by all of them.
Yeah, I mean, at the time I was excited by them. I must say, in my later years, the discovery of triatomic hydrogen has given me about the most of the pleasure, because it was something rather unexpected and something that could have been done 30 years earlier and nobody did. It could have been done when some people were very much involved, more than I was ever,
in the study of the spectrum of hydrogen, and here they didn't find it. Mm-hmm. We did.
Mm-hmm. And that's within...
And that's when I was 75 years old. So I feel rather proud of that. Mm-hmm. No, but I mean, I certainly don't want to belittle the discovery of CH2. I feel proud of that too, but it's a long time ago now.
Mm-hmm. And finally, I think I have to come back to the question of interaction between your subject and chemistry. I mentioned just earlier on, chemists in the 30s were having a terrible problem with free radicals. Did you ever meet F.O. Wright?
F.O. Wright?
Right.
Rice. Oh. Yes, I think it did, actually.
Well, of course, the link is with Dr. Stacy here at the NRC.
Ah, yes.
He was very interested.
Yes, yes.
I mean, his subject was free radicals. But I just wondered, the chemists were having a difficult time throughout the 30s and just trying to convince, well, people like Rice, convince other chemists that free radicals existed, but people like yourselves, physicists, had no problems at all. You were just carrying on with your work. Did you interact during this period along these lines? Did you ever have a chemist come up to you and cry on your shoulder and say that they were having these terrible problems and could you help?
Not really, no. No, I don't think I could say that. I mean, for me, I mean, many diatomic molecules that I was dealing with, or other people in spectroscopy were dealing with, are free radicals. You take OH, you take CH, you take NH. They are free radicals, and it was a perfectly everyday experience to see a spectrum and some under some conditions where OH and CH and NH occur, even in a flame. A flame is a chemical phenomenon. And you see these radicals occurring there. So if the radicals are there, is no question. The only question is, can we find a spectrum so that we can look at their structure? We know the spectrum of OH, NH, and CH, and many other similar ones, SH. And there's no problem. But the problem was with radicals where the spectrum had not been seen, like CH2 and CH3 or NH2.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, of course, would make it very late. This was in the 50s.
Yeah, that's right.
Whereas people like Rice, who were having problems, yeah, this was back in the 30s.
Yeah, that's right.
Their problem, I guess, was not merely identifying the existence of radicals, but they had to know the concentration and then determine the mechanism, which was there.
Yeah. And the concentration, of course, is difficult to determine if you don't know the spectrum. I mean, the indirect chemical methods are somewhat problematic, at least to a physicist, so they appear.
So, do you remember ever having a conversation with any chemist, perhaps Dr. Stacy, about...
Dr. Stacy, I had many conversations with him about...
What were the things that, as a chemist, he was most bothered about, that he couldn't resolve?
I don't know that I can answer that. I mean, he was convinced when I knew him that CH3 existed.
Of course.
And he determined the time of the takes for it to disappear and, I mean, to react with another CH3 to form ethane and this sort of thing. So I don't really think that he was really terribly concerned about that. He had chemical methods to do that. And I think it turned out, on the whole, it turned out to be quite satisfactory.
Well, they went through these different periods, because in the 30s, that was the period when they were trying to convince not Stacy, but Rice, was trying to convince chemists of the existence of free radicals. But later on, he came up with Herzfeld, you know, the Rice-Herzfeld mechanism. But by the 40s and 50s, when you came to Ottawa,
that's right,
they had, they believed in the
But, history. I mean, I began to be interested in free radicals as such after I had this idea about the cometary spectrum, the so-called 40-50 bit, being used for CH2, which it turned out it wasn't. But at that time, I really started to look up some papers by Panet and later papers on the same subject, who were trying to find a spectrum of these things, and at least who first tried to establish that they really exist by moving a mirror from one place to another and this kind of thing. And so my interest started, I would say, in around 1940 or thereabouts. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I thought that the chemists, the physical chemists, the kineticists, that all their things worked out, except it didn't always work, how they would detect free radicals by the reactions that were taking place. Mm-hmm. It was often a little somewhat hypothetical, though, so it seemed to me. But there it was. But I was interested in the spectrum. I was going to show them that here is the CH2 molecule, and here is the CH3 radical, I should say.
Well, what about Bonhoeffer? Bonhoeffer's work was extremely interesting because he appears to be extremely advanced.
Yeah.
When you look back at him, what about your conversations with him? Did he come raising specific problems?
He was the first one, I think.